Welcome to the Embodiment Conference. This channel, Trauma and Social Change, it's absolutely the moment for that, isn't it? I'm Steve Hoskinson. I'm the founder of Organic Intelligence. I've been teaching in this area of trauma, embodiment, and social change for about 25 years. It's an honor, really, for us to be sponsoring this channel where we're going to hear a multiplicity of voice, all unique contributors to our collective understanding of how to move from trauma and support then social change. Our unique voice in organic intelligence has something to do with a koan that I'd like to present to you, which is trauma means unintegrated resource. And that's a koan, and if you'd like and are feeling intrigued about that riddle, then tune in to the post-trauma system development course that we are offering here. The coupon code that'll get you half off on that is ENJOY. Now, enjoy this next presentation, and we'll look forward to another meaningful time as we explore these topics, trauma and social change. Enjoy.
Awesome. It's really, I've seen these sponsor videos multiple times, and every time it's just so cool that the thought leaders in the space are the ones supporting the channels and these programs. Mm. With that said, you know, trauma, nervous system, it can be triggering. So if you're listening in, certainly step one is take care of yourself. If you need to, you know, tune off for some reason or go for a walk or find the bathroom or find another glass of tea, definitely priority number one is the self. So with that said, get comfortable, sit back, and let's enjoy Joshua's presentation.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Appreciate the introduction. And I got a compliment as a learned person and also on the beard. I mean, so things are starting off great.
Happy to help.
Yeah. Yeah, nice to see that, you know, there's a lot of people plugging into trauma and social change. That there's an interest in recognizing that, you know, change processes depend in some way on trauma healing. And you know, this is a big part of kind of what launched me into the field of traumatology, got me interested in somatic experiencing, was a real interest in potentiating shift in our culture, and really seeing how, you know, it looked like things were marching along towards ends that were not life-affirming and not supportive for the health and resilience of any of us. And you know, I was an ecological activist and social activist for a long time and just got really dispirited with how unsuccessful these movements had been. And got really interested in thinkers who were starting to track how individuals and cultures subject to these disintegrating forces of trauma are what is driving this great great dislocation, you know, this great experience that we seem to be having as a culture and as a world towards increasing polarization and distress and disorder. So it's been great. You know, I've been involved with somatic experiencing as our session host mentioned. I love SE. I've been presenting on SE for a long time now. I'm super passionate about it. And understanding trauma, how to work with trauma, is something that that you know has come to feature in a central way in my life. But all the time running in the background is this awareness that, you know, what I feel like I'm really here to do is to potentiate more systemic shifts. And so this understanding of trauma healing really as a way to point towards larger social or cultural change that that we really need. You know, it's not just a question of, you know, ethics or right ways of being in the world. You know, we're teetering on the brink, and you know, everybody can feel it. And to be honest, there's a way in which my nervous system is relieved, because I've been experiencing this sense of that teetering on the brink for a long time, and seeing the signs, and you know, trying to kind of shout it from the rooftops, and now it's like people are starting to have the conversations that my friends and I have been having for, you know, 30 years, and so in a way, it feels like we're in a really potent moment, and I'm excited to participate in that. In addition to my work with the Somatic Experiencing Trauma Institute, a couple years ago, I launched a nonprofit called Revolve Foundation. And Revolve is definitely integrates a trauma healing perspective, but is more oriented towards seeing humans and seeing who we are and what we need for well-being, and how current cultural modes don't support that. So I want to get into some of that tonight. And to in service of that, I created a PowerPoint because I thought, how nice for people not to have to just stare at my face while I do this. So I put this together. It's hot off the presses, so I'm hoping that it's going to serve us well in our journey tonight. So yeah, I titled this as the nervous system strains towards liberation. You know, I think that we're all moving in this direction of liberation, and that, you know, really taking care of our nervous systems is something that that we need to put right at the center of our work. So first question, what's going on with humans? And you know, we look around and you know, I mentioned polarization. We live in a world that is war torn and huge lack of cooperation between peoples, and the, you know, the recognition of the humanity of all peoples, and you know, the signs that there's something amiss are everywhere. And you know, there's now you know, billions of us, I think, trying to figure this out, and I want to talk about that. I want to get curious about human nature. You know, what is human nature? And the phrase that I've added in here is that the stories we tell determine our lives. So the narrative that we weave about what human nature is, I think, has a deterministic influence on what's possible in our lives and what we can achieve both individually and collectively. One of the major shaping forces of our notion of human nature in the Western context, at least, if not more broadly, is, you know, what we've inherited from you know, the Judeo-Christian tradition, the monotheistic religions, which is this notion of original sin, that humans are a fallen creature, and that we have this taint, that, you know, we may have originally been created good, but then through our misdeeds have become evil and are eternally battling the forces that would undermine, you know, our efforts to achieve goodness. Quite a dispiriting sort of narrative. And one way in which we could start to think about this is veneer theory. And veneer theory was the coinage of this term comes from Franz de Waal. And it's basically describing this idea that that humans are these selfish, greedy, violent, destructive creatures that require the shaping forces of different, you know, Christianity, civilization, to keep those instincts from expressing themselves. And it's this veneer, this that is created for us by conditioning, that keeps us from being, you know, even more horrific than we already are. And he quotes this I think Gazellin is a biologist, but what he said was, what passes for cooperation turns out to be a mixture of opportunism and exploitation. And then this is the real famous part of it. Scratch an altruist and watch a hypocrite bleed. So altruism, of course, is that helping others, you know, targeted helping. And there's lots of people in the world who just don't believe this is real. Franz de Waal has this great graphic for veneer theory. This is his sort of tongue-in-cheek depiction of what most people think about human nature. That at our core, we're very bad. And then, you know, maybe outside of that, bad. And then not good, but then on the very outside, the veneer is, you know, our moral tendencies. But again, you know, if left to our own devices, it's going to be a horror show. What I'm going to suggest instead is not that human nature is this intrinsically fallen and awful morass of antisocial tendencies and vicious, destructive instincts, but is instead a reflection of how our culture is a mismatch. So you've likely heard this term, you know, more and more, this notion of a mismatch theory is popping up. The recognition, you know, that's mostly so far gained influence in the worlds of diet and exercise, that our evolved tendencies are not being well served by our current situation. And so this is a common graphic, you know, it's sometimes subtitled, Somewhere Something Went Horribly Wrong. And you can see, you know, this movement into bipedalism and uprightness, and then our journey, our descent, you know, our journey back back down as we now, you know, many of us more and more, especially during quarantine, you know, assume these hunched over postures in front of our screens. And, you know, this whole experience that our organism is trying to negotiate right now is one in which nearly all of these needs that we come into the world with, these things that our ancestors enjoyed and that our organism still expects, you know, we have a dearth of those, and that that has a cost. So I want to try to get into now understanding the needs of the human animal. One of these, a major one, is sociality. And, you know, I'm going to say that humans are the most social animal on the planet. In our wild state, in, you know, small scale hunter-gatherer groups, the context in which our species evolved and spent the vast majority of its time, you know, on this earth, we lived in incredibly intimate small groups of, you know, roughly 25 to 50 individuals. So, you know, we lived in and amongst individuals that we were bonded to because we shared DNA. You know, they were literally our family, or they had married into our group or were in some other way integrated into our group via some sort of ceremonial undertaking. So we were constantly amidst others, and, you know, we lived in this close communion with other individuals. You know, I think that we likely would have spent very little time alone in our ancestral environment. And I know for some of us that have you know, introvert tendencies, that might sound like a bit much. You know, for sure, you know, people took time, and, you know, there was an ebb and a flow. But importantly, you know, we didn't spend our lives by ourselves. You know, we didn't spend our lives in our apartments or in our cubicles. You know, we lived within and amongst others. And, you know, this was a powerful signal to our nervous system of a kind of safety and belonging, something that we very much rely on. You know, I'll sometimes talk about how the worst punishment that we can dream up for an individual is exile. You know, when someone breaks the rules of our society, they are sent away. And if they then go to an institution and break the rules there, you get sent into solitary confinement. You know, that's the worst thing that can happen after, you know, one of the worst things that can happen has already happened. You know, you get sent into these places where you spend, you know, 23 or more hours in total solitude. And there's now increasing awareness that that readily creates mental disease. You know, so people go psychotic in those environments because we need each other. We need others. And you know, this way in which modern life has become more and more fragmented is I think productive of some small scale version of that reaction of psychological pain. I'll also just briefly mention here Stephen Porges and his polyvagal theory. You know, I mentioned that being together with others is a powerful signal of safety. You know, for a critter that, you know, doesn't really have fangs and claws and, you know, biological features that would allow us to, you know, protect ourselves. Being together was a powerful aspect of our survival repertoire. And Porges, you know, with his polyvagal theory, has put together this really compelling hypothesis that the autonomic nervous system, which is the part of our nervous system that governs the functioning of organs and glands, it's there, it's running behind the scenes all the time, telling our heart how fast to beat, telling our lungs how fast to breathe, telling our blood pressure what it should be, you know, everything, all that stuff that happens in the background that we don't have to think about, that's all the autonomic nervous system. And we've inherited this notion of the autonomic nervous system that is overly simplistic and misses really important things, like this way in which it appears that the autonomic nervous system is wired up to the neural pathways that control muscles involved in social engagement. So I know that sentence was a lot. I'll try to unpack it without getting into too much detail on this polyvagal theory because it's quite involved. I'll do whole weekend workshops on the polyvagal theory. And it's a fun, you know, if you're a science nerd like I am, you will have fun with this polyvagal theory if you haven't already checked it out. But the main idea here is that the parasympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system, the brake pedal of the autonomic nervous system, the one that calms us, it is part of that parasympathetic system, has these interconnections in the brainstem to the nerves, the neural pathways that control the muscles that we use for producing speech. So the larynx, pharynx, the muscles in the middle ear that tune the eardrum so that we can extract the human voice from our complex acoustic environment. The muscles of the face that we use to like express ourselves to others, you know, as we say, or you know, whatever it is, there's a neurological thing that happens as we use our facial muscles to engage with each other in spontaneous ways that actually sends a signal to our bodies that, you know, the heart can beat a little more slowly, respiration can happen a little more slowly, blood pressure could go down. You know, the parasympathetic system settles us. And it appears with this polyvagal theory that that is directly happening, not because we're thinking a certain way or interpreting things a certain way, but it's directly happening in this bottom-up way because we're using our muscles of social engagement. And, you know, that facilitates our nervous system functioning most efficiently and healthfully. So the more that we can get back to that, you know, to this being engaged, being oriented to our surroundings, ready to engage with our surroundings and using our social engagement system, the better off we're going to be. I'll also just briefly mention here the attachment researcher, John Bowlby. You know, he wrote a long time ago, 60s, about something that he called the environment of evolutionary adaptedness. So Bowlby was really interested in how do children mature into psychological maturity and health, and saw the various pitfalls that come when you know, children face challenges in their environment. And was part of, you know, getting attachment theory going. But he was very clear that, you know, the need to outline attachment theory and to start to investigate the inner life of the child and how it leads to adult psychopathology was because our culture had veered away from this environment of evolutionary adaptedness and really saw how our species, when we lived in small-scale hunter-gatherer groups, you know, that it in many ways buffered us from a lot of the challenges that we face in our modern environments, which don't tend to support those kinds of relationships that we need to develop healthy attachment. So that's a little bit about our sociality. I'll also name another need that we have is this, you know, being in the world in a way that we can receive our sustenance. You know, being in a world that is rich in those things that we need, and where, you know, where we can receive those things as a kind of gift. In the modern world, in the modern context, we tend to think, you know, you gotta suffer. You know, you gotta work for a living. You have to create what you need. And, you know, I think life for our ancestors was very different because they lived in a world that produced everything that they needed. Everything that one needed to thrive was freely given from the world around us. Its bounty was, you know, is miraculous. And, you know, we see here a human person with one of the most important tools for being a human on this planet, the digging stick. You know, our ancestors figured out a long time ago, you know, as these omnivores who availed themselves of the full bounty of nature, you know, that there was a tremendous amount of food under the ground. And, you know, a good amount of the human diet before you know, agriculture, were roots and tubers. So, you know, getting in there in the earth and discovering these magical gifts, you know, of the earth, was a big part of staying alive. I'm not going to sing that song as much as I might want to right now. Here we have, you know, a berry harvest and, you know, the certain times of the, you know, our ancestors ate a very, very varied diet, lots of different food sources, and throughout the year, you know, would rely on different kinds of foods. You know, part of the wonder of this, you know, of this world that we live in is that it's constantly offering up different things at different times of the year. And, you know, in berry season, you know, there's this window of time where there's, you know, and if you live in the Pacific Northwest, you know this, that, or lots of other places as well, of course, but you really recognize that there's this period of time that's, the world becomes very sweet. And, you know, if we can head out there and just pick up a storm, you know, we'll get to eat and enjoy. And then we can also dry, you know, those fruits and then render them into other foods like, you know, pemmican or other things that we can eat later on. Then I have here, you know, cave art that, you know, seems to suggest hunting, which is of course part of how our ancestors made their way in the world. And, you know, they did so via these incredibly intimate relationships with animals, where other animals were understood as our kin. And, you know, myth wove these interrelated narratives, you know, that humans came to be, you know, in some groups, humans came to be through one of our progenitors that mated, you know, with a particular wild critter. Or, you know, there was these ways in which, you know, the human animals and other animals, you know, shared this past. And, you know, there was this tended to be this kind of reverence for those animals that we depended upon for survival. Oftentimes too, a sense that animals would offer themselves up. And, you know, in rituals around the world, humans would come together to ask animal nations to cooperate with us, you know, by sending us a gift. And so, you know, again, so much I think of this experience of being a hunter-gatherer, you know, of course there's travel involved, there's you know, effort, sometimes tremendous effort involved in, you know, things like tracking and stalking animals. But at the same time, you know, I think a really different way of understanding one's relationship with the world and one's sustenance. Also here, I'll just mention, you know, I say, let us never underestimate the psychological benefits of understanding that one already possesses the knowledge needed to survive. And one of the things about our ancestors was that each member of the group would have known everything that they needed to live. You know, I think about my life and, you know, if the refrigerator breaks, what am I going to do? You know, I have to get on the phone and call someone else because I don't know how to take care of my survival needs. I don't have the capacities to go into a wild landscape and survive. I'm dependent on, you know, other experts. You know, if my car breaks down, I would have no idea what to do. So, you know, there's a way in which in the modern context, we become dependent. And I think that there may be something that kind of gnaws at the back of our mind, you know, and says, you know, if the food trucks don't come, like, what do I do then? And, you know, there's a perhaps a low grade stress that comes with that, you know, especially over time is going to have an effect. Another need that I want to talk about is biodiversity, you know, living in a rich landscape that mirrors back to me all of these different facets of my complex being. You know, when you're in wild environments, you know, there's a plethora of different plant and animal species, and all of them have unique characteristics. And there's something in this that is important for us, you know, that we're around that kind of richness and we're around that kind of diversity. Too often in our modern contexts, you know, we experience a real dearth of that. And because I think we have what is called biophilia by some, E.O. Wilson, I think, was the first person who offered us this biophilia hypothesis. Biophilia defined as an innate attraction to life and to affiliate with living things. You know, this is something that I believe is within us. And, you know, lots and lots of research now has borne out the healing power of nature. You know, we get sick less often, we recover faster, and, you know, we experience, we report greater levels of well-being if we're allowed to look at other living things. So even seeing out a window greenery has an effect on our health. And, you know, bunch of different studies now have shown this. And, you know, they're even now looking at the different volatile, you know, compounds in different plants and exposing people in the lab to those scent molecules and seeing how that also, you know, has an effect. So just seeing or just smelling, but more likely a combined effect, you know, of that multi-sensory experience of being in connection with a rich variety of other species is a big thing that our species needs. And unfortunately, I think that we tend not to recognize that and think that we can live in industrial landscapes or what I'll sometimes call the gray and be okay. So another thing that we need, and you know, this is should be obvious. Maybe it is obvious. I don't know. And that's a coherent culture. We need to be engaging with others in a way that's healthful. When I think about ancestral life ways, you know, one of the things that these cultures had figured out was that the human psyche needs what we can call rites of initiation, these carefully calibrated and carefully timed rituals that facilitate psychological maturation and the movement out of childhood and into fully mature adult consciousness. Lots of these that I could point to, but you know, often at a certain point in adolescence, you know, individuals will be sent into the wilderness to experience separation from the human community, and in that, often initiated into a deeper sense of connection to and communion with the wider world. When I think about my adolescence, you know, what was my rite of initiation? Like getting a driver's license, you know, getting drunk for the, there's not that communication from the human group that says, you know, we really honor you and value you. And here is, you know, how you become an adult. And, you know, as you move through this process, that is an intelligent process that has come down to us through untold generations, you will weave your way more deeply into our collective being. Also, in these cultures, rites that balance the human and the more than human world. Lots of research has gone into what sometimes is called shamanism. You know, the role of certain individuals in cultures that are closer to the earth. And often the role of the shaman is a lot about balancing the relationship between humans and the more than human world. And, you know, to have an individual or perhaps the whole group together really focused on that, really maintaining our relationships of reciprocity with the others, you know, the four-leggeds and, you know, the plants, all those critters out there. You know, I think that that really offers us a sense of belonging, but a sense of ease, you know, as there is this this sense of a coherence, you know, that our human culture, our human community is in some kind of harmony with everyone else. And then I'll also say, you know, that there are in coherent cultures, rites of communal healing. And I'll sometimes term this, you know, re-ensouling individuals. As mentioned, I practice something called somatic experiencing, which is a trauma healing approach. And one of the influences on somatic experiencing is the time that Peter Levine, the developer of SE, the time that he spent with earth-based cultures, you know, and the things that he saw as people sometimes called shamans or healers would invite people's souls back into their bodies. And, you know, when I think trauma, I'm thinking, as do many earth-based cultures, soul loss. You know, that there's some essential aspect of my being that has been lost. And so, you know, you read in Levine's work these tales of, you know, the shaman calling the soul back into the body of the afflicted person and saying things like, you know, your people are all here, you know, your children are here, and we're all waiting for you to come back. And, you know, having these pathways to work with those times where all of us are going to go through things and really need the assistance of our communities and of our people is another part of coherent cultures that we sadly don't see as much in the world today. You know, healing often in the modern context is two individuals go behind a closed door and do some mysterious way of talking with each other. And that's, you know, how the healing happens, which is what I do. Don't get me wrong. I think that's incredibly valuable. And, you know, it's one of those ways in which I think that we are discovering an accommodation that we can make. But that the need for that accommodation, I think, reflects this other deeper loss that our culture has not really reckoned with yet. Another aspect of this coherent culture that I'll just briefly name, there's a near consensus now in anthropology that our ancestors were what are called fierce egalitarians. They were fiercely egalitarian. Egalitarian just refers to, like, there's no one individual that is more important than another. And that we, you know, in these environments, you know, property was very minimal. Things were mostly shared. And if one person got too big for their britches and kind of tried to exploit others or start to boss other people around, they would get feedback. And the group was fierce about, you know, we are not going to be governed. And so, you know, people would get shamed, they would get made fun of, they would get exiled for periods of time, or even sometimes attacked, you know, if they were not being fair. And so I think, you know, that whole sort of fairness and justice orientation that for sure we come into the world with, you know, if I think about my 3-year-old, and my 8-year-old, actually, you know, the constant refrain is, that's not fair. You know, it's like, I know that this isn't okay, this thing that's happening. And I can feel that. And I can't abide that lack of fairness. You know, if something is divided unequally, it's like it just offends their basic sensibilities before they can even really, you know, have a theory about why. You know, it's like, that's not fair, and I know that that's not right. And so, you know, in coherent cultures, that orientation, that innate orientation towards fairness and justice is not beaten out of us by parents who say, well, the world's not fair, and get used to it. get in line. And instead, the human community has ways of managing our shared actions so that we all have a say. And then finally, just mention health and wellness and the ways in which, you know, those environments supported our bodies to be healthy. You know, we were eating diets rich in diversity, obviously unprocessed foods, getting lots of good exercise. You know, I like to say that, our ancestors didn't work a ton, but the work that they did do, it's kind of funny that it's like stuff that we do as recreation. You know, so the work that was required in the ancestral environment to gain our sustenance was like, hunting, which now, you know, people pay thousands of dollars to do. It was, going on a hike in a wild environment to go and discover, wild foods. You know, it's so much of the things that we know are important for us and we do to try to balance how stressful our modern lives have become were the things that would have just been daily life in these earlier environments. So those are a few of the things that I think of as needs, and I would like to progress into talking a little bit about what we're seeing now and how it's different. So we mentioned there at the beginning the importance of our sociality, and in the modern context, our movement towards social engagement isn't as well supported. You know, we're surrounded by strangers in the modern environment. I think that really exerts an effect on our sense of well-being. You know, in that ancestral environment, we would have been constantly surrounded by our group, by that band of, you know, roughly 12 adults and lots of little ones, where we were constantly around babies. We were constantly around the people that knew us. An environment in which everybody knew our name and everybody knew all of our stories. And there was this this intrinsic sense of belonging. And now, you know, we're in a world that is very, very different. And, you know, we constantly negotiate and navigate being around people we don't know, people who we don't know have our best interests at heart because they don't share those bonds of blood and ceremony with us. We also have social media, which is an attempt again to accommodate things, but we're seeing more and more how it doesn't seem to satisfy our innate needs and is creating a lot of unwellness. Thinking about instead of receiving sustenance as a gift, you know, people are working hard. Once we started to do this agriculture thing and became more and more industrialized, we became more and more chained to labor. Mentioned here in an essay by Marshall Solins, The Original Affluent Society, which looks at a particular group of hunter-gatherers. And Solins, anthropologist, kind of sat and watched and took notes and figured out how much work they actually did. And the amount of work that they did compared to the modern Western person was significantly less. So the work that was done to meet basic needs, very much fewer hours, and as mentioned before, you know, more pleasant activities. There's a more recent book about these folks called Affluence Without Abundance. And as we moved into agriculture, it had an effect on us. Like this quote from the book Sex at Dawn: skeletal remains taken from various regions of the world dating to the transition from foraging to farming all tell the same story: increased famine, vitamin deficiency, stunted growth, radical reduction in lifespan, increased violence, little cause for celebration. For most people, the shift from foraging to farming was less a giant leap forward and more a dizzying fall from grace. So as our diets became more limited and we were doing more of this backbreaking labor, trying to minister to the needs of our crops, it really took a toll on our bodies. So here's a depiction of this fall from grace. Also, you know, I mentioned earlier this biophilia and our need for engaging in a rich environment. And, you know, we've really seen how urbanization has removed that. And, you know, many people now live, you know, the urban environments are increasingly, you know, attracting people, gaining more prominence, dominance, and people live without other life forms. And that was articulated really well by this fellow, Paul Shepherd, who I've said is the most important philosopher of the 20th century. Shepherd wrote some wonderful books, which I can really highly recommend. And in there, he talks about how, Nature and Madness, talks about how being surrounded by other humans and human-created artifacts makes us crazy. You know, that our psyche really needs animals, really needs life forms, trees, rivers, rocks, in order to be sane. So lastly, or not quite lastly, but close, you know, we talk about the need for a coherent culture. And, you know, what we have instead is this, you know, you can barely call it a culture, you know, this life way of dislocation that was exported around the globe with colonization. And we could talk here about this doctrine of discovery, which gave European Christians this sense of legitimacy to take their way of life and their philosophy all over the world, and in the process decimate many of these coherent earth-based cultures in this rapacious quest to dominate the entire world. Finally, assaults on the body, you know, in the modern context. We have the standard American diet, you know, the acronym is SAD, and I thought this was a funny graphic. We may look like a happy meal, but we're making your body sad. You know, rather than that diet that our bodies have evolved to thrive with, you know, we have a bunch of things that are really good at getting us hooked and making people rich, but really don't serve our health. And then, you know, also a lack of movement, you know, our sedentism has become quite extreme. This was a sort of alarmist graphic. Sitting is killing you. You know, lots of people now saying sitting is the new smoking. And, you know, for sure, our bodies just weren't designed for these things. And I think we suffer. So I'm rushing a little bit here. We're getting close to the end. And I do want to leave at least a couple minutes for some discussion. So initiated this movement of Revolve, and our mission statement, I want to credit Lisa Holt with the wordsmithing for this. Revolve calls ancestral capacities into the present moment to catalyze resilient human culture in these shifting times. So what is revolving? The recovery of the band. So rediscovering that wellness that can come from relationships with others, and recognizing the innate need we have for engagement. The practice of ancestral living skills, you know, remembering those things that our ancestors did on this planet to live, and, you know, really beginning the process of crafting with our hands and wild crafting, and coming back into relationship with nature in that way. Recognizing the healing power of nature, you know, getting out into wild environments, natural landscapes, and receiving, you know, the positive effect of that. trauma renegotiation for individuals and communities, you know, recognizing the trauma of Western civilization. You know, another person that I can point us to as a resource is Chelis Glendinning, who wrote this great book called My Name is Chelis and I'm in Recovery from Western Civilization. And really, she's a psychologist who really traced the psychological effects of this modern way of life in a way similar to what we're doing here. And then finally, bodily wellness, you know, really finding those ways to take care of this temple of our bodies and seeing how our conditioning doesn't equip us with the best ways to take care of ourselves. So this graphic spoke a lot to me of the coming together that is really what we need right now. So, it is 7 minutes till the hour. I know that we do need to wind down here soon. As is usual for me, I had thought that that was all going to go much more quickly and we'd have lots of time for Q&A. And I even had a little experiential exercise that I was going to have us move through. But it so rarely seems to work out the way I intend.
Joshua, let me just interject quick. It was perfect, you know, and I want us all just to take a nice big inhale and exhale to really marinate on all that just came through. That was profound in a lot of ways. We do have two questions. If you'd be open to answering them semi-briefly, we've got about 3, maybe 4 minutes for Q&A, if that feels aligned for you.
Sure, let's try it.
Okay. So first question is from Jim. He says, does open dialogue represent an effort to revive communal healing away from one-to-one?
Yeah, not exactly sure what open dialogue refers to there, but I know that, you know, you kind of see more and more different places. Groups of people coming together and opening up space, you know, a la the Quaker meeting, you know, where we get to just share with each other. And people are, you know, I think in trying to heal a little bit from the polarization that is so common now, seemingly really interested in hearing from each other and in connecting.
Yeah. Awesome. And then Heidi had a few questions. Heidi asks, I'd love to hear more about how the nervous system controls muscles in the eardrum. So maybe more of a technical question. And then she also had a more general question. I'm wondering why there aren't any references on the slides. Is there a book or theory that relates to this, to the thesis of this talk? I took the liberty of answering that one just in message format, saying that you gave credit to anybody that you referenced and that this talk is essentially a theory that is your own body of work and your own research. But if you'd like to speak to that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's lots of different studies that I could have and probably should have referenced for interested readers to follow up. And then, you know, also mentioned some of the writers that have been really influential for me, Paul Shepard, Chelis Glendinning, and of course, there's many, many others. And please do feel free to get in touch with me. I will put my contact info in the chat. You know, I'd be happy to hunt down any of the resources that I referenced here and go from there. And then, yeah, nervous system controlling muscles in the eardrum, that might be a little deep to get into, but the real brief sketch is just that the neural pathways that do control those muscles originate from a place in the brainstem that is also where that part of the parasympathetic nervous system that's mostly responsible for control of heart rate and other autonomic functions originates. And so because they kind of branch out of that same nexus, that same nucleus, there's a theory now that they actually influence each other. And so as we're more social, as we're engaging and using those neural pathways, it tells the parasympathetic nervous system that it's okay to calm down. And then vice versa, that as we calm down, it allows us and supports us to be more connected.
Awesome. Yeah, for those who are familiar with polyvagal theory, I think that's being that more ventral vagal, that open, connected state, which again, it's been so cool to see just all these themes throughout the conference really coming together. I think the volume of people interested in embodiment right now is truly a testament to this need for us to regulate and to come back into our power, truly.
That's right. Thank you so much, Ravi. I appreciated your introduction and the way you're coming in now to kind of wrap things up. And it's been good to get to participate in this program.
Awesome. Yeah, and that's a great segue into my kind of final part here is, so Alicia is dropping some amazing links in the chat for ways to keep engaged with the conference. There's a Facebook group that's easy to find. And now is the best time to upgrade to get full access to all the content of the conference. We're in the final 48 hours of the free content. And after the conference is over, the price doubles. So if you want access to this recording and literally 1,000 other recordings that are inspiring just like it, now is the best time to do that. If you are a trauma worker, there are discount codes and opportunities to get access to the conference for free or for a high discount. Joshua's website is linked here as well as his contact information if you want to keep in touch with him. And then lastly, there's also the coffee break. If you want to go into the embodiment conference portal and continue this dialogue to reflect on what you just heard and connect with other people, that's a great place to continue the conversation. Again, on behalf of the conference, thank you so much, Joshua, for showing up, for sharing your wisdom in your presence. I could listen to you talk for hours. Your diction and language is wonderful. And storytelling, it all really struck a chord for me.
Very learned man.
Yeah.
I'd love to say thanks to Steve Hoskinson, who's the sponsor of the channel, and also somebody who he was a significant mentor of mine, and just eternally grateful for his influence. So.
Awesome. And lastly, thank you to our participants for your presence and engagement during this conversation. And before we wrap up, Joshua, I want to throw it back to you just for one final, what's the one tip that you'd like to leave us with around embodiment?
The one tip. It's like, feel your feet and feel your heart.
Love it. Feel your feet, feel your heart.
Yeah.
I can get done with that.
Great.
All right, everyone. Have an amazing rest of your day.